You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Prashant Parameswaran, who is back in the United States after a long trip to Southeast Asia. How's it going, Prashant?
Good.
And Prashant, you'll have to clear the air on this recent ASEAN-China ministerial meeting in Kunming, China. So as listeners may be aware, ASEAN and China aren't known to have the best relationship. In fact, there is a broader question that looms over ASEAN, which is basically how united is ASEAN, specifically how united is ASEAN when it comes to dealing with China over the South China Sea. Last week, while Prashant was still traveling in the region, the ASEAN foreign ministers, after their meeting in Kunming, released a very confusing media statement, which several sources picked up on. And then 3 hours later, the statement was retracted. And that drew a lot of attention, and a lot of commentators jumped on it as a sign of ASEAN unity collapsing in the face of Chinese obstructionism. And ASEAN, as Prashant, I'm sure, will clarify, is, you know, it's not a monolithic group. You have four states that are claimants in the South China Sea that have an actual stake in the sovereignty of individual features. You have a few states who aren't claimants but are interested actors, such as Indonesia and Singapore. And then you have a few states who really have no direct stake and actually have a lot to gain from maintaining a good relationship with China, like Cambodia and Laos. Anyways, Prashant, I'm going to turn it over to you since you've done a lot of great reporting on this. You're probably the only person that's actually spoken to a lot of people at these foreign ministries within ASEAN. So tell us a bit about what exactly happened and what the broader takeaway here is.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the issues that you mentioned sort of came to a head at this meeting. So broadly speaking, it was another instance where China adopted a rather heavy-handed approach in dealing with ASEAN and the South China Sea issue, applying pressure on the grouping and dividing it to prevent it from achieving consensus. So you'll recall the same thing happened in Phnom Penh in 2012 when Cambodia was chairing ASEAN. Several diplomats who were at the meeting told me separately that China, initially at the deliberations, not only warned ASEAN not to adopt a separate statement following the upcoming PCA verdict on the Philippines case against South China Sea that you and I have written about extensively, but that Beijing went as far as to question the idea of ASEAN centrality, which is sort of a much-prized principle. And then when it was clear that a rather frustrated ASEAN was going to issue an individual statement instead of one with China, which is, you know, rather unprecedented for ASEAN.
Especially when they're on Chinese soil.
Exactly, yeah. And it was quite bold in terms of the language itself. You know, some of the language in the statement talked about eroding trust and confidence in Southeast Asia and the region more broadly. And I think Beijing, unsurprisingly, tried to get ASEAN, when it was trying to issue its own statement, to instead sign on to something that China had dropped. And this was called the 10-point consensus. And this, my understanding from several diplomats, it was done at the very last minute. And that then led a couple of Southeast Asian states to sort of peel off, notably Laos and Cambodia. And that led to the statement not being issued as it was originally scheduled. So that's sort of the big picture of what occurred.
Could you just elaborate a bit on this idea of ASEAN centrality? It's important, and I'm not sure, you know, it's immediately clear to some of our listeners. So could you go more into that?
Yeah, so it's basically this broad idea that for various reasons, the regional security architecture in the Asia Pacific is sort of centered around Southeast Asia and ASEAN. So whether you look at the ASEAN Regional Forum or you look at the East Asia Summit, a lot of these things are East Asia-wide, and some of them extend beyond East Asia as well to include South Asia. These mechanisms were ASEAN-led. And so the idea is that the implicit trade-off is that ASEAN will continue to be the center for much of this regional architecture that's emerging. But ASEAN also expects that it will be sort of in the driver's seat a lot of this architecture. And the reason for that goes back to the history of ASEAN's founding, which is that it has to deal with big powers that are converging on the region manage that, but also try to take a leadership role so that it's not only reacting to what these big powers are doing in the region, but also trying to actively shape that. And obviously, ASEAN, relative to China, Japan, South Korea, the United States, Australia, is not really the best or the first place you would think to manage an entire region's architecture. So obviously, there's an implicit challenge there, and that's where this idea of divisions within ASEAN comes to the fore. Because as you have more powers like the United States, China, Japan, other countries increasingly converging in the Asia Pacific, that's going to put more pressure on ASEAN as grouping as it tries to deal with some of these issues.
Right. So, you know, to go back to the broader picture here with Kunming, I think the big takeaway that you revealed was that before the ASEAN ministers wrote down this media statement that was released and then retracted, consensus existed, unity existed, all 10 member states acquiesced to that. And then afterwards, with Chinese intervention, Laos and Cambodia got skittish. That's correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I think that there's two sort of rubs that came off after the meeting. And the first one was whether there was actually a statement to be issued or whether there was actually meant to be just a sort of media statement or media guideline. And I think, as I pointed out in one of my pieces clarifying this, you know, both of them have an element of truth to it. So yes, it's true. Initially, the statement that ASEAN was going to issue existed as a media guideline, which was drafted well in advance. However, there was consensus among all 10 ASEAN countries initially to turn that media guideline into an actual statement to be issued. And after the 10-point consensus, Laos and Cambodia sort of backed out of that. So the distinction between the media guideline and the joint statement is actually one that's actually a sideshow relative to the bigger issue that we're talking about. The second issue was Malaysia's decision to, or some might argue, you know, a lack of decision or intention to issue a version of that statement when it came out. And then that eventually led to the retraction. So that then led to another question, which is, you know, was this really supposed to happen? Is ASEAN being bureaucratically incompetent? And my understanding is that the whole Malaysian issue is kind of a sort of sideshow to the entire thing.
Right.
Because the main issue is that, as you correctly pointed out, if we're going to hone in on one issue, consensus existed among all 10 members of ASEAN to issue a statement. And then after certain developments, most notably China's introduction of this 10-point consensus, there was now suddenly no consensus. And Laos and Cambodia most notably peeled away. And so that's the main headline if we're going to talk about the meeting in general.
Right. It's very perplexing. I mean, so before, you know, moving on to the second part of the podcast, which will focus on North Korea, I did want to ask you one final thing, which is that, you know, we want to look forward here. The Permanent Court of Arbitration's decision is around the corner, could be released any moment, really. And we've seen some interesting posturing from Cambodia specifically. Prime Minister Hun Sen went off on a big rant, essentially speaking out in support for China's position. But then the Cambodian foreign ministry came out a few days later and said, that's actually not true. We do support, you know, the arbitration process. So Cambodia has been kind of dilly-dallying. But, you know, the broader question I have for you, Prashant, is where do we go from here? I mean, the Laos summit is coming up later this year, the leader summit for ASEAN. There's a lot that's going to happen between now and then. As you've noted, ASEAN consensus has been somewhat eroded by Chinese intervention. So do you think the consensus that existed before that media statement is easily recoverable, or has there been some longer-term damage that might take the ASEAN countries a little bit longer to figure out?
Yeah, so I think the positive, optimistic way to read this is that this special foreign ministers meeting, which comes, as you pointed out, before the ASEAN ministerial meeting that Laos is going to be hosting next month, as well as the upcoming PCA decision, is actually an early warning sign for ASEAN and concerned states about the South China Sea issue and how ASEAN as an organization and the international community more generally is going to confront it. So I think the big takeaway for these countries will be how to make sure that at the ministerial meeting that's going to be hosted in Laos next month, a similar thing doesn't happen like we saw in Phnom Penh in 2012, and we actually have a joint statement, not only have a joint statement, but have a joint statement that's going to have strong language on the South China Sea. And I think the baseline for strong language on the South China Sea, in terms of what I've been hearing, is the U.S.-ASEAN Summit in Sunnylands language. And that language mentioned specifically not only principles like freedom of navigation and overflight, but also talked about respecting international law. And that's as close as I think you're going to get within ASEAN for support for the Philippines' case on the South China Sea against China. So if that kind of language comes out next month, I think that would be pretty positive for ASEAN. But if we don't see any mention of international law and just sort of general principles, I think that's going to be read quite rightly as sort of a failure. Now, the other issue is, and I'll conclude very quickly on this, the question about whether, in addition to a joint statement, ASEAN is going to issue a separate statement on the arbitration case. Much of that will be determined, of course, by other factors, including when the decision is made. But, you know, I would argue strongly for ASEAN to issue a separate statement on the arbitration case. And this is not something that's out of the ordinary. ASEAN foreign ministers have issued statements after various incidents, including North Korean missile tests, for example. So ASEAN should make a regular habit, as it's done for several other issues, to comment whenever there are issues of regional and global importance. Because if you want to be taken seriously as an organization that is going to play a significant role regionally and globally, you should be commenting on issues that happen like this. The South China Sea is probably on top of that agenda.
Right, and I think it'll be interesting with the inauguration of President Rodrigo Duterte next week in the Philippines, since he'll be essentially the one to lobby ASEAN, most likely. I don't anticipate the decision will come out before his inauguration. So it'll be interesting to see how the Philippines takes the lead there as well.
Absolutely, yeah, I think that's definitely the case. So I wanted to move now to the second part of the podcast on KIT.
All right, let's do that.
And talk about North Korea and the recent missile launches that you've been monitoring quite closely for us as a diplomat. You wrote two pieces about that since it occurred. The missiles, there have been, you know, sort of the fifth and sixth attempts by North Korea to test this mid-range Musudan missile. Neither of those missiles reached their estimated range, but they appear to have constituted at least partial advances, at least by North Korean standards, in terms of the distance, the altitude, and I guess the significance of this missile capability is that if North Korea fully is able to operationalize and test it, it's going to be able to threaten not just a number of Asian countries, but also potentially U.S. territory of Guam as well. So I'm wondering if you could sort of walk us through what's the main takeaway from this test that we've seen, and what does it constitute?
Yeah, thanks, Prashant. I think you outlined the contours of this really well. So both tests did demonstrate partial degrees of success, but there's actually a pretty important difference between the fifth and the sixth test. And I'll talk about that in a bit, actually. But I think what's interesting is that North Korea has essentially been carrying out these tests of the Musudan or Hwasong-10 intermediate range ballistic missiles since April. It actually held the first test of the system on April 15th to coincide with Kim Il-sung's 104th birthday anniversary. Unfortunately, that test failed, which is a little bit sad for Kim Jong-un. He couldn't properly honor his grandfather. He'd actually carried out the purported hydrogen bomb test near his own birthday and the satellite launch test in February on his own father, Kim Jong-il's birthday. So the symbolism of the launch really did matter. But anyways, you know, usually when North Korea tests a system and it fails, it demonstrates a degree of rationality. I mean, rocket science is hard, so what their scientists usually do is they'll go back to the drawing board for a few months before trying another attempt. But in this case, North Korea tried another test in 2 weeks. Those failed as well. And then finally, on May 31st, it attempted another test, and that failed as well. So essentially, they'd seen four Musudan failures. Earlier this week, when they decided to ultimately launch these final two tests, the first of those, which is the fifth overall test, resulted in a flight distance of 150 kilometers, which is, you know, well short of the range that the Musudan is expected to reach, which is around 3,500 kilometers. That's on the surface of the Earth. So from the North Korean launch site to any other target on Earth, it can travel 3,500 kilometers. So obviously 150 kilometers wasn't great, but it was an advance over the previous launches. The sixth missile is, however, the one that I think we should talk about, and we shouldn't really understate it, as, you know, being sort of a success by you know, North Korea's, you know, admittedly lesser standards, but it was actually quite impressive in the sense that they managed to get the missile to fly to an apogee of over 1,000 kilometers. North Korean state media reported 1463. The Japanese Defense Ministry quoted 1,000 kilometer apogee, but basically both of those numbers just mean that it flew really high. And the way that ballistic missiles work essentially is by using the propellant, the liquid fuel in this case, to propel the payload way out of the Earth's atmosphere, out of the exosphere, and then essentially using gravity and air resistance to do the rest of the work in the terminal phase as the missile heads down towards its target. And while the apogee was 1,000 kilometers of the sixth missile, the distance was only 400 kilometers, which I think some people are misreading as an implication that the IRBM's range isn't quite where it should be. But essentially, the simple explanation is the way ballistic missiles work. If you shoot them at a steep enough angle, the lateral distance is actually a lot shorter. So we really don't know. I mean, it sounds like with this apogee accomplishment, particularly the one that North Korea state media is reporting, North Korea can probably get one of its Musudans to Guam, which is a U.S. territory. And now I'll talk about the political and a significance of this. And so Kim Jong-un announced his Pyongjin policy recently, which is essentially a guiding strategic principle for North Korea's highly managed state, which says that North Korea's two overriding goals will be to attain a credible nuclear deterrent and economic prosperity. So everything we've seen in the past 6 months since the thermonuclear test, there's been solid fuel testing, re-entry nose cone, stress testing, all sorts of, you know, engine testing as well, and SLBM, submarine launch ballistic missile test. All of these things really point towards the one side of Pyongjin, which is the nuclear side. And the Musudan capability is particularly important because Pyongyang really wants to show the United States that it has the capability to credibly deliver a nuclear device to U.S. territory. And while we don't know if North Korea's miniaturized nuclear device can actually be mounted on the Hwasong-10, since it's a smaller frame than the larger KN-08 ICBM intercontinental version, we do know that it likely can get there after this sixth test, which is quite significant. So Guam matters. But also, you know, I do wonder, going back to this Workers' Party Congress that we just saw, that if North Korea had succeeded in April, would we have seen a little bit more economic clarity at that Congress? And I wonder, because a lot of North Korea watchers essentially noted that the Congress was a bit of a bust. I mean, Kim did announce a 5-year economic plan, but it wasn't any sort of sweeping reform. But I do wonder, you know, if the April 15th test had succeeded, we may have gotten a bit more. But, you know, going forward, I think North Korea will probably slow down with its testing of Musudans. I mean, partly there's a practical reason, which is that they have a limited inventory and every test costs them fuel, costs them an actual Musudan frame. So they're probably not eager to give up too many of those. But also, you know, there's a famine brewing in North Korea, and Kim Jong-un really hasn't shown any real attention to the other leg of Pyongjin. So I feel like I rambled there a bit, Prashant, but hopefully that's a good rundown.
I was wondering, though, you mentioned towards the tail end of your second piece, how this dovetails with and how it relates to North Korea's diplomatic attempts with respect to China and the United States, and how that might or might not play a role in terms of what Pyongyang does next with respect to testing. Can you sort of elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a reason I didn't really actually bring that up. It's because I think Pyongyang's signaling has been quite confusing. So there was this meeting at, I forget if it was late May or early June, but around then when a North Korean high-level delegation visited Beijing, and actually you had the first photo op of Xi Jinping with a senior North Korean official. She has never met Kim Jong-un, so this was actually a pretty big event, and it comes, you know, a few months after China acquiesced to essentially the strongest UN Security Council sanctions against any state since Iraq in the early 1990s. So really, it was a pretty important event. I mean, it showed a sign that Pyongyang was maybe interested in making its ties with Beijing improve. They haven't been great. Obviously, China wouldn't have acquiesced to the sanctions if its relationship with Pyongyang were a little bit better. And actually, this past week, North Korea also sent a high-level delegate to a Track 1.5 discussion with the former states that comprised the six-party talks, which are now long dead and unlikely to restart anytime soon. But, you know, Prashant, then the thing is, you know, if you send a delegate to a Track 1.5 dialogue, but then you test an IRBM contravening UN Security Council sanctions, I mean, what's the message that's ultimately sent at the end of the day? So it is a little bit confusing. I mean, Pyongyang's on one hand trying to reach out. The sanctions are hurting, no doubt. China's supposedly implementing them better than most people thought. But, you know, it's unclear where North Korea is looking to go. And honestly, you know, with the United States election coming up, I don't think that the Obama administration is really going to look to abandon its policy of strategic patience. I think it's really going to come down to the next president. So I wouldn't really hold my breath for any real change in either North Korea's diplomatic outreach or the international community's outreach to North Korea for the rest of this year, at least. Great. Well, that was a pretty long podcast, but we'll wrap it up here. And we actually struggled, Prashant and I, to if we should include India's ongoing bid to the nuclear suppliers group. But for listeners, definitely tune in next week, because I think we'll talk about the result of that bid. And those deliberations are actually going on right now as we record this in Seoul, South Korea. If India gets in, it'll be a big deal. If it doesn't, that's also a big deal. So there'll be a lot to talk about either way. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and do leave us a rating on iTunes. And if you're interested in hearing anything on this podcast that we haven't covered yet, do either reach out to me or Prashant on Twitter or by email, and we'd be happy to consider that for future inclusion. Thanks for listening.